Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Weekly Pulse Sunday. My name is Jeff Snyder, founder and CEO of The Morning Pulse, and I am joined by our audio technician and also advisor, George Grumbacher.
Hey.
Hi, George. How are you, bud?
Great.
And I should say you're joining us from Arizona. So, you know, we are coast to coast, north, south, east, and west. And then also joining us from New York City, is Miss Natalie Walters. She's a tech reporter from The Motley Fool. Natalie, how are you?
Doing great. Thanks for having me again.
Thanks for coming on. And I guess our audience should know that, you know, we're a live to tape operation. We do very little editing, and so you're hearing it as we're saying it. Guys, great to be with you again. We're going to be wrapping up the week in retirement and the markets, and of course tech with Natalie. But it's a long weekend here. It's Memorial Day weekend, and I think before we even get started, we need to definitely acknowledge the men and women who have, obviously passed away in service to our country, preserving our freedoms to give us the opportunity to do a show like this and to talk and speak our minds. So thanks very much to them for their sacrifice, their family sacrifice.
Amen.
Yeah. Amen.
Amen. So, George, let's start with you. You're an advisor. You're servicing retirement plans. You're talking to folks. What's top of mind for you, and what's been top of mind in your podcast this week?
Top of mind for me is, number one, today's National Wine Day. So get out there and drink some wine if you haven't already. It's okay to drink wine for lunch, everybody. But I also read that college 18 years from now is going to cost twice as much as it is today. And I have essentially a baby at home. So that means I need to, double the amount that I'm saving for his college education. So that's kind of a bummer. But the podcast was great this week. We had Carolyn McClanahan on Tuesday, and she is a medical doctor and also a certified financial planner, talking about the connections between your physical health and your personal finances. And had Marv Feldman on Wednesday, and he is the CEO of Life Happens, and that is an organization that its job is to get awareness out about fundamental protection products like life insurance and disability and long-term care. And he is the son of Ben Feldman, who was the best life insurance salesman in the history of the industry, so that was interesting. And wrapped up yesterday with Sarah Davison, who is a United Kingdom divorce professional, so learning about how to move forward from divorce. So we were all over the board this week, but they were great shows, and people should check them out for sure. So
yeah, definitely, and they can do that on Podbean, and we'll post that URL when we post the show on Sunday. So sounds like a great week. You covered a lot of wide range of topics,
no doubt,
all retirement and finance related, and you know, I think going back to the college savings, you know, college for those who wish to go to college is important, and it's astronomical what the costs are. So hopefully we can there can be ways to kind of manage those costs over time, because as we've talked about on the show, student debt is a big problem for many of the people who are graduating today and people who have graduated in the past.
Yeah, it could be a really crushing thing, certainly. So
yeah, absolutely.
So that's the reason that James is out practicing sports right now. I'm not sure exactly what kind, but there's hand-eye coordination going on. So
I'm glad to hear that. And Natalie, shifting gears to you on National Wine Drinking Day or National Wine Day, what's going on in the world of tech? I know there are a couple stories that you're covering, you're following this week that are top of mind, one of which is Amazon and the Amazon Echo or Amazon Dot. Did I get that? I might have gotten that wrong.
Yes, the Echo. Yes, they're both run by Amazon's Alexa voice assistant, but the Echo is the more popular one. It was the original one. And so there's been some controversy about it this week because, as everyone expected might happen eventually, a conversation between a husband and wife was recorded and sent to the husband's colleague on their contact list, and Amazon confirmed the mistake happened, and they said what happened is the device misinterpreted background conversation as a command to send this conversation to that colleague. Thankfully, the conversation was only about hardwood floors, but the couple still said they unplugged all of their Alexa devices, and it kind of I guess maybe that's a good warning for all of us, because I actually have an Alexa, an Amazon Dot. They're kind of the cheaper, smaller version. I got it on sale, I think, for maybe $30, $35. I keep mine unplugged a lot of the times, and I think maybe it's because of these conversations I've heard that you'd rather be safe than sorry, but it's convenient for other things. You know, I ask it for the weather or to play music, things like that. But it's interesting. I'm wondering what you guys think about that, or if you have any of those devices.
Well, I don't have an Amazon Echo or Dot. I do have an Amazon Fire Stick, and I use that, and I can talk to Alexa, but I have to push a button. I guess for me, George, you know, it just kind of goes back to what we were talking about several weeks ago with Natalie on Facebook and this privacy issue. I know some of the vendors that work in the retirement space have started to enable Amazon Alexa type technology to help people look at their accounts and whatnot. So, you know, obviously it's curious. It's can be a bit scary, as Natalie intimated. But from an advisor's point of view, what do you think?
Well, I mean, data protection is everything, and it's I think it almost feels at times like it's impossible to get your arms around it, but it is something that we're going to be talking about from yesterday and, you know, years ago through the foreseeable future. So there's always going to be ways that we're going to be getting better at it, and there's going to be new things to worry about. So I personally do not have any of those devices in my home, and it's not because I'm paranoid, and it's also not because I think that I'm having conversations that are so ultra-secret that I wouldn't want anybody to hear them, but I think I'll wait for another couple of iterations while they get these bugs worked out, because I'm sure it's not a nefarious thing. I'm sure it was just kind of a bug, so.
Right, very rare case.
Yeah, let's hope it is rare, because you know, I mean, next thing you know, whatever they were talking about could be inadmissible in court. I mean, there's so many different angles to this. I think people can play, but
I take back my previous statement. I do not want any of my calls recorded.
Well, we are.
Yeah,
you know.
There was actually a case last year where there was actually someone drowned in a bathtub, and there was an Amazon Echo located in the bathroom, and the police were wanting Amazon to release the noise that was recorded during that time period to see if it could help them figure out what happened. And I believe Amazon ended up having to hand over that voice recording, but it was only because the person who was being accused of the crime said, it's okay, I'm okay if Amazon releases it because I know I didn't do it. But so yeah, you're exactly right with that. It can be used in a lot of ways.
Well, I guess watching. More to Yeah, I guess Big Brother, Big Sister, Big Everything is watching. So I guess there's more. We're going to be covering this story you're going to be covering this story, Natalie, these types of stories for a long time. I think it's the new it conversation. So what else are you kind of seeing? I think there's something with Apple and Volkswagen.
Yeah. Yes. So there's been talk of Apple maybe partnering with BMW and Mercedes to make both the hardware and software for an all-electric self-driving car. But those plans have fallen through because Apple didn't want to give up, you know, some control over the design of the vehicle, as is typical of Apple. And now the New York Times is reporting that Apple's actually partnering with Volkswagen to make self-driving shuttles for its Apple employees. So this scale-back effort for making, you know, this full-fledged car that would perhaps be sold to the masses to just working on self-driving shuttles for its Apple employees might explain the layoffs that a lot of people have been reporting have been happening on the self-driving car project in the past few years. There's been hundreds of employees laid off from that, and that might be why, because they're just making the software now for this sort of limited project. And I think that's the right decision, because Apple's a design company, not a manufacturing company. And I think starting off with a small project is probably the right thing for it to do until it can get all the kinks worked out. And then maybe in the coming years, it'll expand on that.
Yeah, I think oftentimes when we have these grant, who am I to speak? But I mean, you have these big projects in mind, and sometimes it does make sense to kind of do things in smaller chunks in order to get them done, and make it more manageable. And then you look at some of the setbacks. I think it was Uber or Google or someone who was had a driverless car, and unfortunately someone was injured or killed.
That was here in Arizona.
Yeah, so I mean, right. there's still some, you know, things that need to be, obviously kinks that need to be worked out to protect the public and the public's interest, and that probably has something to do with it as well.
Yeah, definitely. And then also you look at someone like Tesla that's having a lot of trouble sort of getting cars made from the ground up, you know, where they're, you know, making the cars and the software. And maybe Apple's looking at that and thinking, do we kind of want to go through that messy process to get it up and running when we are really best at making software? Maybe that's our strong point.
Well, I guess more to come. I mean, I think everyone's kind of picking and choosing what niche they're going to be kind of focusing on. And, you know, I know you didn't have this in the stories you were covering, but I just read an interesting story, Natalie. We've been talking about these OTT, over-the-top networks, and Netflix, and I saw that another periodical was discussing ratings in Netflix. So maybe that's something that's going to percolate next week in your coverage. But basically, I guess Netflix doesn't follow ratings when it comes to you know, its viewership, and it just is creating more and more content. It's to the tune of like 8 billion. So I wonder if you'll come across that next week in your travails as you're covering the marketplace.
Oh yeah, that is interesting. I mean, I love covering Netflix, and I've just been talking to some people this week about how for years people were saying, you know, we just want original high quality content, and Hollywood kind of turned their shoulder on that and kept making, you know, a lot of the same movies or remakes, and the box office went down, and then Netflix kind of came into the scene and said, okay, we'll do it, you know, we'll start making original titles people didn't even know they wanted, and they're doing great. You know, people are like, okay, take our money, you know, we'll sign up for this. So I saw that they're releasing 700 original titles this year. So
wow.
I'm pretty excited about that. And I mean, their strategy is obviously working. People, it's a great deal, you know, to pay, I think it's, what is it, about $10 a month, and you're getting access to all these original titles when you can go to the theater for one movie for $15 now. You know, it's a great deal.
Yeah, more to come. I think their market cap is about $145 billion. They spend $8 billion in content, or at least spent $8 billion in content in 2018. Maybe we need more financial content, so maybe they'll be willing to let us come on and do the show. We obviously don't get paid to do this. We do this for a love of educating people, just to be very clear on that. And I guess more to come. So, Natalie, thank you so much for joining us. We wish you a great weekend, and we'll look forward to what you're covering and what you're seeing in the world of tech next week. Have a great weekend.
Thanks so much. Enjoy the long weekend.
Thanks, Natalie.
Well, that was Natalie Walters from The Motley Fool. And now, George, we're joined by a very special guest, the CEO and president of ICMA-RC. They're a record keeper focused on the government space. We're joined by Mr. Bob Schultz. Bob, how are you today?
I'm great, Jeff. Thanks for including me on this call.
You're quite welcome. It's great to catch up with you. Thank you so much for spending time with us. You know, I think, you know, we've covered a lot of issues on the show around technology and infrastructure and innovation. And I wanted to get your, as someone who is responsible for maintaining a record keeper service provider like ICMA-RC, how important is it to an organization like yours to maintain a current technology platform and infrastructure?
Well, it's absolutely essential. I think you have to have the entire continuum, though, from high tech to high touch, really, in order to be a full service provider in this day and age. You certainly need the high tech tools, and we've added a lot of high tech tools at ICMA-RC over the last 3 years in particular. I think we spent over $100 million over the last 3 years just rolling out new customer facing tools that are online, self-service, things that will engage participants and help them plan for their retirement. I'm talking about, for example, we have an MI on Track tool that we've rolled out in the last couple of years. It works with a pension calculator because, as you know, most public employees nowadays still have a pension as their primary benefit, and the DC plan tends to be supplemental. So in order to really do a comprehensive plan, you have to really know what your likely benefits in the future are going to be from both. And it also incorporates a Social Security calculator as well. You know, we have text access too, so you can pull out your phone or your iPad and you can text to an ICMARC server, and it'll tell you what your current balance is and how much you're contributing right now, what your rate of return is, and that sort of thing. So that's for people who don't have regular access to a PC, which is pretty typical, especially among local employees. We have a lot of mobile apps where you can do basically anything on the phone that you could otherwise do on a laptop. And then we've got more recently, we've added some fintech tools like account aggregation, for example, budgeting, debt management, asset allocation, tools like that that, again, hopefully better engage our participants in planning for their retirement. And then, of course, we've had a lot of investments lately in fraud prevention, where we try to identify people, especially people who are calling in and trying to impersonate a real participant to try to get money out of an account. So we've done a lot of investment in fraud prevention there as well. So, but these are all planning tools. But, you know, when I travel around the country and I meet with employers and I ask them, what do you like best about what we do for your employees? They invariably don't mention the high-tech tools. They invariably talk about the high-touch service.
Yeah.
You know, they talk about how important it is for the face-to-face interaction between their employees and an experienced counselor. They talk about how important it is to be able to reach somebody on the telephone who understands their plan and can give, you know, sound advice over the phone. And so, you know, the moral of the story is you got to have both.
Yep.
I think you got to have both the high tech and the high touch.
Yeah, that's something that George and I and our contributors and guests often talk about. You know, that we acknowledge the cybersecurity data protection. That's important. But number two, it's important to have the technology because you don't know who prefers what type of medium. But right. You know, this is really a people business, and I think it's, you know, it still remains a people business, and these are tools that are being developed to supplement or complement that type of business. You know, when you look out, so I mean, obviously your business is really focused on governmental entities. So we're talking, you know, special taxing districts, we're talking states, municipalities, cities, et cetera. What are some of the trends that you're seeing from these entities in terms of what they need? I mean, obviously data protection's got to be top of mind, but are there some trends that you're identifying and you're seeing?
Yeah, definitely are. There's an increasing interest in what I call fintech tools, for example, and that includes things like account aggregation. In fact, we're rolling that out next week. We've teamed up with a fintech company. It'll offer not only account aggregation, but home budgeting, asset allocation tools, debt management. Other things like Social Security optimizers are important in various planning tools. And then increasingly, our plan sponsors are asking us to provide things like managed accounts and investment advice. You know, 10 years ago, I think most of the focus was on what we call investment education, where you'd be limited to really describing for a participant what's in their investment lineup and what's available to them, but you wouldn't tell them or really wouldn't advise them exactly how to invest their money and how to allocate their assets. And nowadays, plan sponsors are saying that's not far enough. We've got to be able to cross the line into investment advice because a lot of plan sponsors are really concerned about the rollover industry. And I think the Department of Labor has really brought to the fore some of the abuses in the rollover industry with the onset of the fiduciary rule. And even though that fiduciary rule has pretty much evaporated, I think it brought up a lot of attention to the problem. So our plan sponsors are asking us, what can we do to keep their plan assets in the employer-sponsored plan and keep them from being rolled out to the high-fee IRA programs? And increasingly, we think that the differentiator that will help us there is to be able to present ourselves as the trusted advisor to folks who are near retirement or going into retirement, and say that, you know, you can get everything out of your employer plan in terms of advice and help that you'd otherwise would get from the brokerage firm down the street. And so we're trying to build out those services, including financial planning from board certified CFPs, you know, including that as a regular part of our service that we offer. So that's just a sampling, I think.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like
sponsors are looking for.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like, I mean, you're not just a record keeper. We're just keeping track of, I mean, it used to be when I was in the, you know, a record keeper, we did, you know, and things were evolving. You did keep track of accounts and money coming in, but it's really more than that. It sounds like, you know, as a service provider, you're no longer just a record keeper, you're a service provider. So you have to do all these different things. And I would imagine that there, you know, we've faced some real price competition, you know, pricing challenges in terms of earning fees, in terms of the services you're providing. There's like a lot of pressure there, and you know, these other challenges like the fiduciary rule and other things kind of put some parameters around things you can and can't offer. So, you know, I commend the fact that you and your record keeping sisters and brothers and cousins, whatever the right terminology is, you're being adapting, and you're being have a lot of flexibility in terms of adapting to this ever changing environment. It's amazing.
Yeah, and also when it comes to providing advisory services, we think we have a lot of credibility because, you know, we don't use commission-based employees. And so, you know, our employees don't really have any interest except the participant's interest at heart when they're providing advice. So we think that's also a differentiator.
I think that it most certainly is. I think that a lot of times when a plan participant is soliciting input or advice, they would be concerned, well, is this person going to make money if they're trying to sell me a product or steer me into a certain area? So I think that definitely is of value.
Yeah. So Bob, to kind of wrapping up, you know, I don't want to leave out stable value as a topic, because, yeah, it's something that I've been in the business, George has been in the business, many of us have been in the business for a long time. You know, stable value, does it still remain a core part of these retirement plans? Not just, I mean, obviously you're speaking to governmental, but is it still a core asset class in these retirement programs?
It really is. And, you know, I can't speak for private sector 401k plans, but certainly for the voluntary 457 deferred comp plans in the public sector, stable value is still really very important. And, you know, we have a great stable value product that we call the Plus Fund, and it's been around a long time. And even in recent years, during this 9-year bull market in equities, you know, it still has a balance of over $10 billion in AUM, and it doesn't seem to be going up or down right now, even despite the fact that a lot of the new money from new employees by default goes into target date funds. And so it seems that the baby boomers still want to be able to have sort of a safe harbor where they can put their money with some principal protection. And I just, in fact, I just read an article this morning on a survey of people under age 35 and their propensity to invest in equities. And one data point was from 2008, prior to the Great Recession and the big market crash. And it said that 52% of folks under age 35 had some asset allocation into publicly traded companies. Nowadays, they just repeated the survey, it's only 38%. And so, you know, it appears that millennials, for example, are still somewhat reticent, you know, about the public equity market. They got to have some place to go, especially when there's a bear market going on in bonds right now. So where are they going to go? You know, between them and I think the baby boomers who want safety, it seems to me that the stable value product is just as valuable now as it's ever been. And we're not seeing any drop in AUM in that program.
Well, Well, Bob, thank you so much. We're coming up to the end of the segment. We thank you for spending time with us. We hope you will come back and check in with us over the course of the year. And we have so many more questions to ask of you. So we thank you so much for your time and enjoy the weekend.
Thanks, Bob.
Thanks, Jeff and George, and hope you have a great Memorial weekend also.
All right. Thank you.
Bye. Welcome back, everybody. That was Robert Schultz with ICMARC. Joining us now are Kevin Kelly and Oliver Rennick. Kevin from Bloomberg, Oliver from TD Ameritrade, here to give us an update on the markets. How are you guys?
What's up, guys?
Doing great. Looking for a long weekend.
Good afternoon. Long weekend it is.
A long weekend. Today is National Wine Day. I don't know if you guys are aware of that. Now you are.
Well aware of that.
I was aware last night, but that's good.
Excellent. Kind of like Christmas Eve kind of a deal. Smart. Kevin, kick us off, sir, please.
Absolutely. So I'll touch on some of the big moves this week. We got a little insight into the FOMC with the FOMC minutes being released. What was kind of interesting about this one, you saw a little bit of market reaction is, you know, we've talked about it, how the expectations, you know, 3 to 4 rate hikes this year, what does that mean for the rest of the market? And it seems like the Fed has taken, you know, still a pretty firm stance. 3 rate hikes is definitely certainly in the mix for this year. But it seemed like, you know, outside of June, which at this point, if you look at, you know, the probabilities of rate hikes, actually the market's pricing in 100% chance of a hike in June. If you look out farther, the expectations are a little bit more muddled now. So when you look to September, you look to December rate hikes after that, it seems like just from the tone of the Fed, just from the minutes release, it was a little bit more kind of dovish in the medium term to longer term this year. So it'll be interesting to see how that plays out. I mean, I still think we would need something really to derail them from that three additional rate hikes throughout the end of the year. You know, it seems like Jerome Powell is very much set on, you know, having this coming in, having this firm stance and not really kind of backing off from it this early into his term as chair. So that's something that, you know, we've been watching. You saw a little bit of a pullback in the 10-year yield. So you saw prices increase for 10-year bonds, which gave a little bit of a boost to some of those, you know, what we call the yield proxy sectors, which is like your utilities, your real estates of the world. So that was some of the price action this week. But I mean, longer term, still, you know, I think I've talked about it on here. We're still much more in favor of some of these kind of more, you know, what we call the cyclical sectors over the defensive ones, which basically means that as you get later and later into, you know, the market cycle, you no longer can really just rely on whether it's valuation expansion or multiples expanding. You really have to see that underlying earnings growth. And we had a really good first quarter earnings. Everything, you know, across the sectors came in above expectations. But you need to continue to see that moving forward. And, you know, I think it's really where you start to see the winners and losers kind of dissipate a little bit. And you get to see a little bit of dispersion in the market, which will be, you know, really interesting and could make for a good, you know, active management space as you see people really gravitate more towards the profitability, companies that have strong profitability and ones that, you know, aren't as highly leveraged or have a lot of debt as rates rise. So I think that's going to be kind of an interesting dynamic that we're certainly watching to play out, you know, throughout the end of this year.
Excellent. Mr. Rennick.
Yeah, I'll add some on to that. I think that basically this is a very different market if you talk about sort of long versus shorter intermediate term, because everything Kevin just went through, I think, is sort of a generally accepted consensus for the longer term picture for a shift in policy that is driven by a tightening monetary policy from the Fed, right? End of QE, all that type of stuff. What we've been a little bit more interested in here is just sort of the nature of that transition and what it might look like, because the typical type of market cycle, if you will, or historical standard is not holding up very well. And there are many reasons why it kind of shouldn't. I mean, we just went through an unprecedented period of low interest rates. So it becomes very challenging to find out, you know, what exactly this turn looks like as this big ship turns into possibly the opposite direction. But so that being said, I think there's a few interesting things that are happening, which is we're kind of seeing some surprise in the market that we saw yield through the past couple of days go back down to 3%. But as we've been saying here, you know, without thinking about specific levels or trying to make a call on a percent yield, the idea is that this has kind of been setting up. If you just look around the world, this is why we've been focusing so much on that dollar, because if you're of the belief that the dollar is strengthening because our own data has been relatively stronger than the rest of the world, and the fact that those central banks have had to be dovish, we've been writing about this for the better part of a couple months, then you either have to have a Fed that is totally set on inverting that yield curve because you're going to have that bond demand on the longer end, which seems like they might be comfortable with. But at the same time, that means that you're not going to get a quick move past, you know, where we've kind of been for some of these higher yield levels, the 2.8, 3.1. You know, who knows really how long it's going to take to see any dramatic climb higher. And what then that sets the stage for is kind of what we saw like this week, which is a move back towards, as Kevin mentioned, some of the higher dividend paying companies, those yield plays in the market. It means that if there's going to be a relative value for bonds that increases more slowly than expected, meaning there's not a rush out of equity, well, then what's going to work in equity? Well, I think Kevin's definitely right, and we've seen dispersion in markets for sure. But I think the stalwart will continue to be some of the growth expansion that we've been trading on for a very long time. That's essentially what we also saw this week, with growth valuing out its lead over value, rather broadening out its lead over value again. So all these things are very different if you're thinking about a big picture kind of longer term versus what the nature of that transition looks like. And it's not going to be a clear story. Clearly, this week was a bit of a move that kind of followed our peers around the world, where the market viewed it as dovish and positive stocks. And then you throw in a bunch of other stuff that's going on with North Korea, but that's a whole other topic.
Whole nother can of worms, so to speak. And speaking of a whole nother topic, I'm curious about it, so I'm just going to ask if you guys have thoughts on it. I'd appreciate it. When we're talking about, or we're looking at repealing and rolling back different parts of Dodd-Frank, do you think that that's going to have a positive impact on the market short term, or do you think that that could? I guess my question is, I'm viewing that some of the regulation on smaller banks that are being repealed could potentially lead to speculation, which is what got us in trouble in the first place. Am I being too doom and gloom?
No, I think, it's definitely a the right mentality and the right thought process. I mean, you've already seen a lot of this price action too show up in, to your point, smaller banks, right? So if you look at, you know, just within the stock market, small cap, you know, financials are a majority, if not all of the banks are typically regional banks, right? So, you know, much more kind of domestic focused, the rollback of some of the capital requirements, right? So for some of the smaller ones that had to adhere to some of the capital requirements that the large, you know, big Wall Street banks everyone's familiar with had to abide by, that definitely could be, you know, bullish for those types of stocks in the short to medium term. It also, you know, from an economic growth standpoint, can certainly open up different opportunities for these banks now to go out and lend more. They don't have to keep, obviously, the point is not to have to keep as much capital, obviously, on your books. So there could be opportunities where they go out and they start, you know, really lending. The question then becomes, though, is how extended could that get? And I think this is what you're getting at, is at what point do you really see that kind of almost roll over into a negative side effect? And it's certainly a concern. I mean, I don't think we're there yet. But if you just look at the number of kind of unprofitable companies that are in the market, or even the amount of capital that's flowed into some of these a little bit riskier, you know, VC funds or private equity firms, I mean, you see a lot of capital kind of awash right now. And the question becomes, do we need more of that, where you have, you know, deregulation kind of pushing more capital into the market potentially? Or do we need a true, you know, kind of recession here, where you get that flesh out of companies where, you know, only the strongest survive? And that's kind of capitalism, right, where you have, you know, money moved back around to its most its best use cases. So I'm honestly kind of a little bit more in the latter camp. I know as an equity analyst, you know, I'm supposed to be, you know, long-term bullish on stocks, which I am, but I think there is a certain point where you need to take a breather, have a comeback or have a pullback, and maybe even see, you know, some of these companies fall in hard times, just to again kind of recycle and let the stronger ones rise to the top. But curious to hear Oliver's thoughts, because we could be on totally different wavelengths.
No, I don't have a whole lot of thoughts in terms of the ripple on effect for the Dodd-Frank rollback. It's not really something I think about a ton. I've just been continuing to look at that expansion of the gap between KRE, the regional bank ETF, versus XLF. I mean, this is something that I think is finally coming to fruition for investors who basically bought this entire group of companies hand over fist the day that Donald Trump was elected, and have largely been kind of waiting for some of this to come into account. So you've got the interest rate side and the regulation side, and they checked off at least one of them this week, and the other one got a little bit more murky. But in terms of the ripple effects from legislation, not really my ballpark, but it definitely is a boost to investors who have been waiting for this for a while, for these companies that now can kind of operate without having to worry about getting too big or having to deal with that SIFI label.
For sure. And one more thing really quick, just to kind of tie it all full circle to where we started with the FOMC and the Fed. When you think about, you know, regional banks or smaller, you know, smaller cap banks in value, you know, their business model is a lot different than these bigger Wall Street firms, right? They not only have more domestic exposures and more revenue coming from the U.S., but they're much more, you know, potentially dependent on that yield curve that Oliver was talking about. If you get, you know, a flattening yield curve, you know, their business model is much more heavily traditional banking, which is, you know, you're lending a higher rate than what you're paying on your deposits, right? So if that spread starts to decline, that can really cut into some of the profitability of these banks. So, you know, the rollback of Dodd-Frank hopefully, you know, alleviates some of that.
Excellent. Well done, gentlemen. Good luck this weekend. Go out and have a lot of fun.
Appreciate it, guys.
Thank you, sir.
Hey, have a good weekend, guys. Week.
Thanks Bye-bye. As always.
Thanks. See ya.
Welcome back. So that was a great segment with Oliver Rennick from TD Ameritrade and Kevin Kelly from Bloomberg. And now we're going to turn our attention to someone who actually covers the retirement beat, so to speak. She's Ann Turgeson. She writes for The Wall Street Journal. Ann, thanks for joining us on the show this week. It's great to have you. Great to talk to you.
Oh, well, thanks for having me.
So you write for the Journal and you cover retirement. You cover the gamut in topics. What has been top of mind for you over the last couple of weeks, last few months as you've been writing pieces? I know you've done a lot of work on robo-advisors, you know, planning for retirement, some of the state-sponsored retirement savings plans that have kind of popped up. But what in your mind are some of the biggest things that stood out as you're kind of writing articles and following?
Yeah, I think the state-run initiatives are really very interesting, and the fact that New York recently announced plans to launch its own state-run plan, I thought was really very significant given the size of the population in New York. You know, now when New York comes online, which isn't estimated to happen, you know, immediately, but in the next couple of years, it will have New York and California with these state-run retirement plans, which obviously, that's pretty significant population-wise. So, so I do think like keeping an eye on those plans and their gradual proliferation is just a fascinating trend. And you know, as we kind of bank on the defined contribution system going forward, and obviously have been banking on that for you know a couple decades. It's just the problem of people who aren't covered continues to be a problem, and the fact that the federal government hasn't dealt with it has left an opening for these states to forge ahead, which I think is just a very interesting trend.
Yeah,
you say interesting. I appreciate that. Do you think that's good, bad? Are you indifferent to it?
Well, I'm pretty well. I mean, I'm kind of indifferent to it in that. I don't really have like a sense of whether I don't have a political agenda. You know,
sure.
I don't feel like states should be doing this or shouldn't be doing this. But I do feel like we have a problem, you know, in terms of like millions of private sector workers, like 55 million by the estimate of AARP, they do not have access to workplace plans. And I think, you know, there probably is an argument that some of those people maybe don't need access because, you know, they have, I don't know, they might have other resources, but I think probably the vast majority of them could benefit from being in some kind of a retirement savings plan. So I'm just kind of interested that that this initiative has really taken off.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's
to be proliferating.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting. And I think, you know, kudos to all these states. You look at the ones you mentioned, California, New York, Oregon, Illinois, Vermont. They've all got their own little, twist, but not in a negative way. You know, just a little different look. You know, Vermont, for example, is using multiple employer plans as an example. And I think that's good for the market. I think that's good for, you know, states are the laboratories of democracy, as they say. And this is just another example where states can come up with different solutions. And then maybe, you know, as states aren't kind of operating in a vacuum, right? They're sharing information among themselves. They're trying to learn from each other. And I think that's a good thing. And clearly, I mean, and we talk about it on the show a lot. I mean, there's a coverage issue, and it needs to be addressed. And we need to get people saving more. And you know this more than anybody on the show, because you cover the beat, that we have some challenges in getting people covered and saving. So I guess more to come on that, on this really hot topic.
Mm-hmm. And that's from an accumulation standpoint, from a, for lack of a better term, decumulation or distribution standpoint. I saw that you had written about financial engines being acquired for a massive amount of money. Is that more of a decumulation play to try to capture assets as they leave a workplace retirement plan and potentially move into IRAs?
You know, I think it's financial engines and other 401k providers maybe recognizing that they have opportunities to kind of forge deeper relationships with the 401k customers that they have and to try to hang on to those relationships in some capacity. And I think financial engines may be looking to Edelman to provide a higher level of advice than it currently does. Well, actually, I should say it currently does provide like three tiers of advice, but I think it's looking to Edelman to sort of consolidate the highest tier of advice that it can offer so that it can offer its current customers more ways to interact with it and to maintain that relationship going forward. I think like traditionally when you see a lot of the large 401k record keepers, the Fidelities and Vanguards, and I think they've been quite good at trying to figure out ways to forge relationships with people who are in their 401k plans and to have ongoing relationships with those people as they retire and they want to do the rollover. So I think with this merger of financial engines, my interpretation is that it's trying to do something similar and trying to sort of better position itself to compete on all levels and to try. I think within 401k too, just because of technology and robo-technology, I think there's a greater capacity that different companies have to actually offer advice to 401k clients. And you know, the vast middle market doesn't have a financial advisor and financial advisors historically. So now it becomes more economical for those people to have financial advisors. And I think 401k providers are sort of thinking, well, why shouldn't we be that advisor, you know, rather than waiting until these people are, you know, in their 50s or 60s and ready to retire and roll out. And then, you know, then they roll over and they find some, you know, discount broker or financial advisor willing to take them on in an advisory capacity. The thinking is now, you know, people who are much younger who are still accumulating and maybe don't even have big balances in 401k plans, you know, it's more economical to offer them advice. And then you can kind of seize on that relationship and build on it going forward.
Well, I think that makes a lot of sense. It's, for lack of a better term, almost like an arms race where if companies can offer great service and from every different aspect of it, from accumulation to eventual distribution, all in one location, why wouldn't a company want to do that? So,
And Ann, you hit on an interesting point that we had a CEO of a record keeping company on in a previous segment, and I think you hit on this in your comment about Edelman and a higher level of service for a specific tier. And you know, we have all these great fintech companies and technology, but this is a people business, and people do still relish or want those one-on-one types of relationships. I mean, I consider myself pretty tech savvy, but I still like to interact one-on-one. And I think it's having, being able to offer those people a multitude of options is the business that's going to be probably the most successful in, as you suggest, in retaining assets, or at least attracting assets.
Yeah, and I think, I feel like a lot of these robos started out with just a heavy tech kind of interface, and over time, a significant portion of that industry has really migrated to that hybrid model where you've got a human advisor available for interaction for people who want it. It does seem that that marketplace has really, like, very broadly kind of recognized that that's what customers want. So it does seem to be the case.
Yeah, I would agree. One of the articles, and we touched on this on the show, but I think you have a lot more insight, is you wrote an article about that retirees are less confident about having enough to live on. That's really a concern these days. I mean, you know, my parents are aging. They still work, but, you know, they're in their 70s. You know, the confidence, the ability to deal with the inflationary pressures on certain commodities and other important goods, housing, et cetera, that's got to play on people's minds, I would imagine.
Yeah, it's interesting. In looking at this result where the retiree confidence in having being able to afford basic expenses declined from 85% last year to 80% this year. And I was talking to somebody at EVRI, which conducts this annual survey, about why. And it really, what really stood out was medical expenses. And, you know, thinking about it, Medicare Part B premiums really jumped a lot for, you know, like, you know, a significant portion of Medicare beneficiaries this year. So that was their explanation, and I found that, like, very plausible that might be actually behind this this erosion in confidence about having enough. Medical expenses are pretty high, and Medicare Part B premiums had been holding steady, you know, thanks to this weird hold harmless provision of the Social Security law, which was all premised on low inflation. So it was sort of like artificially holding down the Medicare Part B premiums for a few years. And then when we got an uptick in inflation, the Medicare Part B premiums rose significantly for, you know, some portion of Medicare recipients, like a significant portion of Medicare recipients. And I do feel like maybe people really were reacting to that in this number.
Got it. Well, that is excellent stuff, Anne. We appreciate you coming on today.
Oh, well, thank you for having me.
Yeah, we'd love to have you back. Of course, and we enjoy your writing, and you always bring an interesting perspective to the beat. So thanks for coming on, and have a great long weekend, hopefully. Maybe you'll do some writing on some awesome topic, and we'll read about it in the journal in the next few weeks.
I got to write something soon, so hopefully. But anyway, thank you, guys. Have a good weekend. I hope it doesn't rain on you.
We do the same. Thank you so much, Ann.
Thanks, Ann.
Okay.
Bye-bye. Take care.
Welcome back, everybody. That was Ann Turgeson from the Wall Street Journal. We appreciate her coming on. And joining us now are Alessandra Melito and Jacob Passy from MarketWatch. And Ali, coming off your appearance on Cheddar, it was cool to see you on there. I bet that was fun to do.
Yeah, that was really fun. It's always fun to get to talk about retirement on television.
We like to hear that. We like to hear that. That's awesome. You're speaking to the choir here.
Yeah, I know.
So here we are coming up on a busy holiday, and I think that people are going to find themselves doing all kinds of stuff, but certainly hitting the stores and the malls. So Jacob, fill us in.
Yeah, so Memorial Day has, you know, kind of morphed into one of the bigger sales holidays of the year. You know, it's starting, I mean, I wouldn't say it rivals Black Friday, but it's definitely some of the best sales you will see until Black Friday and the holiday shopping season. But yeah, I mean, the weekend is known for mattresses, and you can certainly find good deals on those. That's kind of where this, you know, weekend sales all started, were these big mattress sales, and that's still very much the case. Another thing to look out for that you should, if you're in the market for it, is car parts. you know, tires and things like that. Retailers will have sales on those as people are getting prepared for summer roads and things like that. But, you know, even though it's some of the best sales of the year, there are definitely certain items you want to avoid. So, for instance, you don't want to go car shopping this weekend. Car parts, fine. Cars themselves, you won't find as great of deals because they're not rolling out the new inventory yet. And so that's basically what you see a lot of when it comes to the deals that aren't as good on Memorial Day weekend, is that there's not new inventory coming in yet. And so old inventory has been put on significant discount yet. So the best time to buy a car is later in the summer, you know, July, August, September, when automakers start rolling out their new models. Another thing to avoid would be electronics, laptops, televisions. Those are usually what you think of for, you know, Black Friday doorbusters, and that's definitely the better time of year to buy them. Also with laptops, later in the summer, closer to the start of the new school year, there will be deals for, especially for college students. So those deals will be better than what you'll see on Memorial Day. And then the other big thing to avoid, that savings experts told me is clothing sales, especially on like summer apparel, swimwear, bathing suits, things like that. Because it's still really early in the season for that. And so, you know, the new summer items may just be hitting the shelves or the racks, but they're not going to be on significant discount yet. You want to wait until like August if you really want to get savings on those and stock up for next year.
Awesome. That is good practical information there, Jeff. So if you're thinking about buying a mattress, go for it. If you're looking to buy some new threads, hold off, man.
Well, yeah. I mean, I think I like to get a new Tempur-Pedic. You know, my back, Tempur-Pedic, my back is killing me. I've been working out a lot. Wait, do you guys see see me on the TV show? I'm going to be buff.
All right.
But yeah, I need a new mattress, so maybe I'll take Jody shopping this weekend.
I like it.
The experts say to replace your mattress every 10 years at least. If you haven't done it in a while, this weekend's a good time to think about it.
See what kind of advice you get on this show? I mean, we get advice about clothing shopping, you get advice about the markets, and you get advice about health. Obviously, we're not talking about it. We don't give advice on the show. We give education, right, George? We got to keep our compliance people happy.
That's 100% right. So
100%.
I'm not endorsing or giving you advice on whether or not you should buy a mattress.
I understand.
Allie, so I know there's been so much talk about how much 30-something folks should have saved by now, but how much are they actually saving?
So it appears that the answer is it really depends. There are some people who are really – they're well prepared for retirement at 35. They are saving twice – well, they do have twice their salary saved. For retirement, which is the figure that made lots of people mad the past 2 weeks on Twitter. And then at the same time, there are people who have not saved as much, but they're working on it. And that's really all you can ask of millennials, given that we are on the hook for our own retirement savings. So my colleague Maria LaMagna and I, we spoke with some real-life people who are in their 30s and asked them how they're doing. And we got a huge range. So there were some people who said that they only had maybe 40 or 50,000 in savings, and they had a lot of debt that they were paying off. I spoke with somebody who had about 155,000, and he was balancing that with also raising a family. He has a 3.5-year-old and a baby on the way, and he his wife changed careers, so she's building a business of her own. I talked to some people who were especially angry with me for that article I wrote about saving for retirement in your 30s, and they said that they just can't save at the moment. Some people said that they just do not have the money, the extra money in their budget to put towards retirement at the moment, so it's something that they're looking at in the future, or, you know, they're hoping to do in the future. So the answer is everybody is different, and everybody is taking this completely differently than one another.
Well,
And that's the right answer to the question, yeah, because one size does not fit all. So
absolutely.
I like it. Well,
Allie, what was it? Just can you give us a little behind the scenes of your day on TV at Cheddar? What how did it transpire? What was it like?
Sure. So it was pretty easy. We talked about going on the week before, and then in the morning I got there super early, just to make sure. You never know with subways. So I got there super early at the New York Stock Exchange. That was fun. I'd never been there before, but it was pretty quiet because I had gotten there before the bell. And I was terrified, but I just tried to play it cool. And the hosts were really nice, and the producers were really nice. They showed some of the tweets that had been inspired by the article, and we just discussed why millennials may not feel that they can save for retirement and what they can do about that. And it's funny because throughout the whole week, people have been, they've created a meme over this. So now you can get a ton of advice, not on this podcast, of course, but you could get a ton of advice on Twitter about what you should do at 35 or by 35. You know, so it's been fun. Even Chipotle and DiGiorno and Dictionary.com got in on the fun. So.
Wow, that's awesome. I mean, that's pretty powerful. You got some powerful, you got a powerful voice there. Keep using that. Maybe we could do a segment where you bring some of these people on the show. We don't have to divulge their names, and they can talk about their circumstances. That'd be pretty interesting, actually.
Yeah, definitely.
Just thinking about. Jacob, let me ask you a question. I got to go driving this weekend up to Boston to visit my brother and sister-in-law and their children. Oil prices and gas prices, anything you guys are seeing over at MarketWatch on this issue? Anything you can you know, I know they always say go ahead.
Yeah, no, gas prices have been higher lately, and that's actually that is a concern that you know, as we head into the summer road trip season, you know, they're like, I think I saw a figure somewhere that gas prices are like 30% higher than they were last year around this time. And so, you know, that's something that people need to keep in mind. We've been lucky the past few years that gas prices have been really low, and they've been low because there's been an oversupply of oil around the world. You know, the U.S. was producing a lot through you know, shale and fracking, and there was an oversupply from Saudi Arabia, et cetera, et cetera. But now we've burned through that literally. And the OPEC countries, I think, have scaled down their production of oil somewhat. So prices are higher, and you need to keep that in mind. You know, if you took a summer road trip last year, you shouldn't expect to, you know, you need to budget it somewhat differently than you did for this year than you did last year, because the prices are going to be higher. And, you know, that won't just contribute necessarily to the price at the pump. I mean, you know, oil prices, you know, can cause, you know, other goods to become more expensive because the shipping will become more expensive. So, definitely, you know, it's a time to be paying attention, and also, you know, keep in mind where you travel, you'll be paying more depending on where you are. You know, if you're near like a major port city where oil tankers come in, the oil might be cheaper. If you're further away from there, from somewhere like that, you know, the prices might be more expensive.
Solid information. Well, thank you. Right there.
Yeah.
Well, thanks as always, Allie and Jacob. We hope you guys have an excellent Memorial Day.
Thank you.
Bye, guys.
Bye.
Well, there it is, Jeff.
Oh, sorry. Go ahead.
There it is, man. Another week in the books.
Yeah, we should point out our legal eagles, David Levine and Kevin Walsh from Groom Law, are on taking the day. They've got some client work ahead of them, so we'll catch up with them next week. There's been a lot that's transpired on the legislative and regulatory side, I'm sure, and we'll hear from them and get the latest update. But another great week, George. Great work as usual. We've had some great guests, people giving their insight, people who cover the space either from the industry side as a consultant advisor like yourself and I and Bob Schultz, or people who are analysts and journalists who cover retirement and are very passionate individuals about the space. So looking forward to next week. I wish you a very safe and wonderful weekend with your family. And I think you're going to the zoo a little bit later, so I hope you enjoy that.
Thank you. Yes. Yes, James and I are going to go check out the monkeys at the zoo before it gets to be 150 degrees. So you have a great weekend too, man.
Thank you. I'll see you next week, my friend. Take care. And bye to our audience.